Welcome to Crane Radio. Celebrate a life well lived.
Welcome to this first season of The Modern Crone, the 21st Century Shaman. I have invited the most powerful, eclectic and woke shamanic folk I know to talk with me about their take on shamanism and tap you straight into the minds and hearts of those who are the real deal 21st century shamans. Real people, real stories and a whole lot of mind-blowing, spirit-stirring juju. Notwithstanding her early work as a journalist, after an intense period of crises, tragedies and shocks, Louise Gilmore discovered meditation and threw herself into discovering all that she could about it. This led her to eventually learning and teaching meditation and training people to become teachers for 40 years. Shamanism grabbed her in a similar way, and she has explored, practiced and taught this fascinating modality for 20 years. Louise also offers one-to-one shamanic healing sessions, and she just happens to be my teacher, my mentor and my very dear friend, and I'm so thrilled that she's joining me for a chat this season. Louise Gilmore, welcome to this season of The Modern Crone, the 21st Century Shaman. How are you?
Oh, thank you, Danny. I'm quite fine, thank you. Looking forward to our chat.
Yeah, me too. Me too. So let's go straight into it. So the topic for this season is the 21st Century Shaman, and the idea of the podcast is to speak with different people who live the shamanic life and express it in a number of different ways. And I'm so thrilled to talk to you because it was you really that introduced me to shamanism and the practices of journeying and ecstatic posture way back when. It's got to be 20 years ago. Initially, I found you for meditation, and then our relationship has just prevailed since then, which has just been divine. So how would you describe shamanism today?
I think shamanism, modern shamanism, is very different from what traditional shamanism would have been, which is why I feel very hesitant to call myself a shaman.
Yep.
That's not what I or who I am. I'm a practitioner of shamanism. And so modern shamanism calls on some of the fundamentals of ancient practices. But most people who practice it, I would say, marry it into their everyday lives in the everyday modern world. And so it looks very different. I've probably thrown myself into it more than a lot of people perhaps who've maybe studied with me or who I studied with years ago when I was learning it, because I got the opportunity to pursue it, to teach some of the practices and to travel and explore with modern and actually traditional teachers of shamanism. So it's very hard to explain. It's a way of entering altered consciousness. It's a way of entering trance, and in that trance we can find all sorts of things about ourselves, things about the world, a beauty, sometimes a bit of fear, but things that are not really possible to access often without a way of altering our consciousness and going into trance. So that's my aim when I work with people.
Beautiful. So in your intro that you provided for me, you know, you talk about earlier in life going through a series of shocks and crises that led you into a deep spiritual exploration. And we often see this in the shamanic path, don't we? Like the wounded healer or the shaman's death. These are the archetypal terms that are used within shamanism.
Yes.
Can you tell us more about that dynamic? And also, for someone heading down the shamanic path, is it essential as well to go through some form of a crisis?
Oh, absolutely not.
Yeah.
But, you know, the way I look at it is if you're alive, you've probably had some traumas and crises.
Yes.
So it's part of our humanity. It's part of our relationships with others in the world to have difficulties in our lives. And I would say that many people who have joined my classes or come to me for healing sessions come because it's really interesting. They come because they feel they need some sort of respite or healing that they haven't been able to find in other places. And they want to explore more deeply. And interestingly, quite a lot of people have told me that when they first heard about shamanism, and this is what happened with me too, when they first heard about it, it felt familiar.
Yeah.
They kind of went, oh, yes, that's what I need. In fact, my daughter also, same thing. She saw a book about shamanism on my shelf and said, I need that. Where do I get that?
Yeah.
And so if I was to explain as best I can what might be going on there,
yeah,
the fact is that archaeological evidence indicates that shamanism is the very first spiritual practice of humankind. Mm. And it goes back about at least, actually, 100,000 years. And so way, way back in the history of humanity, people were finding these ways to go into altered consciousness. And therefore, in a way, it's in our DNA.
Yeah.
And that's my explanation as to why people often find it strangely familiar, or it draws them in a way they can't really quite understand. I think we know it in our bones, in our genes, in our deepest, deepest self.
Absolutely. And the other thing that drew me to it was very familiar to me as well when you started introducing me to shamanic practices all those years ago, and it filled a bit of a void, I think, that I was carrying around with me. And I think one of the things that really appeals to me about shamanic practice is that there's no requirement for agency. There's no requirement for someone sort of brokering the opening or the access on your behalf. You're mainlining directly a broader field of intelligence and energy, which often in shamanism is referred to as spirit, isn't it?
Yes.
And you're gaining divination and healing directly. And that appeals to me greatly because it does feel innate in my design. So you and I met initially when I came out of the wild of meditation and decided that I'd been doing it on my own for long enough and I really needed some discipline. And that's how we met initially. So you took me right back to the fundamentals. Then I did a mastery of meditation with you. And then I ended up doing the teacher training with you as well, just fantastic, which is obviously now is a major part of my offering with my community.
Mm.
How important is cultivating a meditation practice to access the shamanic path? What's the connection there?
So I think the It's just a matter of terms,
yeah.
You know, of naming things. And, you know, meditation is a technique, and depending on what traditions you explore and follow, it varies a little bit. But it is a way of entering an altered space, of entering silence. Yeah. And for many people, when they first start learning to meditate, that is the very first challenge,
yeah.
To aim for silence. And then as you practice, the ability to be in silence becomes easier. And what you find within the silence becomes so seductive that's what keeps you going. So in a way, I think it's really important for people to have, you know, some guidance, some training. It's really, really hard to learn to meditate on your own, yeah. You know, just from a tape or, you know, something online. It's really difficult to do it that way, because to begin with, you need a framework, and the framework allows you to have kind of rules and guidance for when the mind gets really busy, you know, to be in a class, you know, with somebody who knows what's going on, who can point you back when you need to come back.
Yeah.
But over time, I feel very strongly that those frameworks need to be released time, because the framework itself can become an obstacle. You get stuck with, oh, I'm going to do my practice, and I always do my practice by this step and this and this and this. And it needs at some point, you need to release that. You need to let it go and just begin with your framework, but then go into the silence. Absolutely. And then, you know, that's when the magic starts to happen. So in terms of your question about is meditation necessary, there's something that is necessary, and meditation is a great start, but meditation, the way we look at it in the world today, may or may not be the place to start.
Yep.
But there's some way in which you've got to help yourself to alter consciousness.
Yep.
And meditation can be that beginning.
Yeah, absolutely. And you taught me the steps into shamanic journeying, which is a form of, and I know you're going to explain this better than me. I'm very conscious that I'm talking with my teacher too. So it's the first podcast I'm actually really thinking about how I'm phrasing stuff. you know, shamanic journeying is a way of altering the state of consciousness, moving the conscious mind into the deep mind. So you're very aware, envisioning will happen, and the intuitive senses will inform you of information. And it's just a go-to for me. I now teach shamanic journeying as well. But over the years, you and I have, when we haven't been sharing space, so we've been in different countries around the world, and we have decided that we would meet in the other, that we would both enter journey, we would consciously meet and experience an adventure in the other together. And we've done that numerous times, and we do find each other, and we do share a common experience or vision. And just for anyone listening to this, we've got this routine where we write out or share what we experience and send it to each other, but we don't read the other person's report until we've sent out. So there's no retrofitting of what we've experienced. Mm. So Is it possible that we are entering, when we go into this non-ordinary reality, a shared field of consciousness? Because that's certainly been the experience with our shared journeying.
Absolutely. I think that's exactly what happens. And I first began to understand this when I started training in shamanism with my teacher. And that was in a group. It wasn't a big group, you know. Shamanism, you know, didn't attract a whole lot of people, maybe 12, 15 people. And we used to do a lot of work in pairs. And I realized that what was happening was that we were entering some kind of shared reality.
Yep.
And you know, so over and over and over again, we would discuss what our experiences had been. And even now, I still join a group, sometimes in person and sometimes online, that does the ecstatic postures, which yes. is another way of altering consciousness, which has its roots in a sort of shamanic, ancient way of being. And then we debrief, and then, you know, and this is part of the research of the organization that runs this in America, in Santa Fe. And so they are researching the commonalities that happen, and they're actually attracting interest from research organizations, scientific organizations, medical organizations who want to test, you know, what happens to blood pressure and all of that as well.
Yep.
So this is, you know, at the beginning it was, oh, wow, this is so extraordinary. Look what's happening. You and I sitting next to each other can enter some kind of reality.
Yeah.
But now I've learned that space and time don't exist in that reality.
Totally
and
incredible.
So,
yeah.
Yes, but intention does.
Yeah, yeah.
Yep. So, yes, it's kind of, it's so apparent that we can meet on this level in a realm and not have exact experiences but have shared experiences. And sometimes those experiences build on each other, and we can learn something from what I experienced, what the other person experienced, or sometimes a whole group can be saying, well, we took up this posture and 50% of the group went up into the sky and stuff happened, you know, or you know, a whole range of things. So it's a beautiful way of finding how limited our ordinary understanding of what's real and what's not real can be.
Totally. And it also really evidences the oneness of it all, you know, the oneness of existence, the oneness of consciousness, which is beautiful, because we live in such a separated state in our modern life, separate from each other, separate from the land, separate from spirit, you know. Well, that's the perception. I think our most all of our cool journeys are awesome, but the one that I think was probably the most incredible, was the most adventurous one, was the recently on the solstice when we joined the Uluru ceremony. You were in your home on the East Coast in Australia. I was here in Singapore. We found each other, and we entered into a ceremonial space through the same way. The same things made us laugh. You sent me packing. I wasn't allowed to sit next to you, and you saw that. You saw me sitting opposite you, and then exiting that space underground as well. And meeting with the ancestors. I mean, there were so many shared, very real, very felt experiences in that journey. Yet we were nowhere near each other, and neither of us were near Uluru.
Yeah, yeah, and you know, I think that people are really seeking that kind of connection.
Yep.
And this is a very random comment, but I actually think that some of this kind of chasing after sexual satisfaction, porn, you know, that yep. sort of thing, is about this urge to connect in such a deep way, and that sort of alteration of our being that happens with sex is the best way, the only way sometimes that people can make that connection. And yet, you know, we're actually connected all the time, but we've forgotten how to remember it. You know, we just don't remember that we have that connection energetically all the time.
Absolutely. And I think you see it, don't you, a lot in your meditation circles, where you're not even necessarily doing a sort of a deeper shamanic practice. You may even just be doing breath work and a simple visualization. But very often there'll be people in the circle that have the same realizations, or interestingly, and this used to happen with me when you were leading us all the time, is I had the sensation that I was like 2 seconds in front of your guidance. So I'd have the thought of where the meditation was going, and then you'd say it a couple of seconds later. And that happens in my circles as well. And I think that's that interconnectedness again, which is not bound by time.
Yeah.
And I've seen it too in plant ceremony as well, particularly peyote. I've seen that where the plant medicine seems to work through the group mind rather than an individual mind. And you know, it's a thing. We're able to do it. It's incredible. Okay. Oh, so good. I could talk to you all day. Let's talk about dreaming. Yes. So I get asked a lot for help with interpreting dreams, which is quite a fun sort of pastime, to look at correspondences and speak with the person and help them interpret the messaging from their subconscious mind. And you might remember when I first met with you, my dreaming can be, well, pretty rigorous. and I used to go to you all the time and go, well, what does it mean? What's it telling me? And I remember it stayed with me all the time. Ever since then, you said, well, you can interpret it and that's fun, but the active space is in the dream. So and the Lakota shaman talk about the dream space as the healing space. So whether we interpret it, whether we can wrap a thought or an abstraction or a concept around what happened in that dream is secondary, because the action happened in the dream. Can you talk to us a bit more about the dream space?
Well, I guess the dream space is another altered state of consciousness. And just as, you know, if we're in a peyote ceremony, or if we're, you know, doing a shamanic journey, that space can inform. And yet, at the same time, I feel that putting a conscious mind interpretation on things is imaginary. We're making it up. And making it up is okay. Everything about me as a personality is invented. But if we make the mistake of thinking that that is what we are or who we are, then we get really stuck and really bogged down. Because the reality is that who we really are is open space. And so that makes me less interested in what my dreams are telling me, or what the interpretation is.
That's exactly what you taught me. You know, is look, it's fun, and you can look up what a red apple falling off a tree means, but really that's secondary to the fact that you're existing in these different dimensions of consciousness.
Yes.
And but I think that our proclivity to define and label and conceptualize everything can be one of the biggest obstacles of our spiritual progression as well. Because, for example, when we have movements of energy that go through our energy body, even if they're uncomfortable, you know, which are essential to our movement and our experience of life, and we'll go, oh, I'm anxious today, or I'm angry today. And as soon as we label it, we disconnect from mainlining it, don't we? And yes, also potentially allowing it to run its course and ripple through, which is what it's naturally. Yes. And so, you know, I talk about this a lot with my groups as well, is to reframe how you're observing and experiencing energetic movement, and instead of calling it something, just feel high sensation. It's high sensation. That's it. And allow the high, sit in the high sensation. That was another thing that we did in our studies, was the sitting in the fire, you know, sit in the fire.
Crane Leaving speaking.
I need a boyfriend.
Well, we have Señor Sombrero, Asakusa-san, or if you swing that way, Antoinette is available too. Check them out on crane-living.com and enjoy 10% off with Radio 10 when you cart out.
Oh, okay.
Terms and conditions apply. Don't get too excited. These are just names of our collections. We don't work that way. If you'd like to interact with real humans, come down to our flagship store at 46 Kim Yam Road.
So you mentioned earlier, Louise, your work with ecstatic posture, and I only got to do one very initial module with you before our life paths took us to other places, and it was an extraordinary experience. So you taught me bear posture.
Yes.
And I had an amazing experience where a bear presented in the vision and sealed my inner vision, and I couldn't see. And it was right in the middle of doing my major assignment for you, which was on shamanic journeying. And I remember thinking, how am I going to finish this? Because I can't see. And you thought that was highly amusing. And also, but what came out though was amazing. Like I was 3 months, I'd lost my inner vision, but what I did do was learn how to trust my other senses.
Mm-hmm.
My other inner senses, which was the whole lesson. And and then when I understood that, that bear arrived again in vision and tapped my eyebrow center, and my sight came back, I couldn't believe how effective that it was. A sort of semi-squat, putting the fingers in a certain position like mudra and holding it. I couldn't believe how that zapped me so quickly into a non-ordinary state of awareness. So could you tell us a little bit more about ecstatic posture? I mean, do they come from cave paintings? Am I remembering that correctly?
They do. Yes.
Yeah.
So there was an anthropologist called Felicitas Goodman who was led, she didn't set out to explore this sort of thing, but she was living in the US and exploring the glossolalia, you know, the speaking in tongues, actually.
Yeah.
And anyway, she came across various paintings, as you said, cave paintings, and she became more and more interested and began to really explore not only cave paintings but also little sculptures and figurines, many of which are in museums and art galleries around the world. They're often very ancient, prehistoric, and they've, you know, in the sort of placing of them within the museums, they've often been labeled as being gods or goddesses or, you know, whatever. And she began to wonder whether they were not only images of gods, but they were actually coded instructions of how to change consciousness. And because she had students, she did a lot of testing of a number of postures that she chose, working with the debriefing and the similarities that took place.
Yeah.
And over time, she worked with several other people, and she's no longer alive, but there is a couple in Santa Fe who continue her work. And at the moment, what they're doing is bringing in new postures, and so expanding the number of figurines, postures, civilizations and tribal groups who might have been doing this kind of work. And it just is beginning to really unfold. So at the moment, I'm part of a group that meets every couple of weeks on Zoom. We explore a new posture each week, and then we compare our details, and they make notes and add it to their research material. So those postures, I'll tell you a funny story about that bear posture that you just mentioned.
Yeah, yeah.
Because when I found out about this, which is probably 10 or 12 years ago, yeah, I don't know, maybe more, I've forgotten.
Yeah.
And it was because I bought a book that they had published with the postures in, and I went, oh, yes, I want to try this. And so I got in touch with them because I wanted to include it in both my meditation teaching and my shamanic teaching, because I thought it sort of bridged that. And I asked them, what was a posture that would be really safe? and they recommended the bear posture, because if you read about the bear posture, the bear is recognized in North American Indian understanding as the shaman of the animals, and as this wonderful mother figure, and very, very safe. And so it interests me to be reminded of your experience with that. And strangely enough, just a few days ago, I was talking about this to another former student of mine. He was my student only about 4 years ago. And I started to tell him about the bear, and he said, don't you remember what happened to me when I did the bear posture? And he'd had an experience where he completely changed how he looked, and he was working in a pair with somebody else who also saw that he looked completely different. And
yeah,
he's an Aussie guy who looked like an Asian man.
Wow.
And the man who was sitting opposite him saw this difference. So I just think it's really interesting,
yeah,
that particular posture, which I thought, oh, I'll do it because it's not too challenging, it's pretty safe.
Yeah, I know, gosh.
And this man was going, oh, my God, what happened to me?
Yeah, shape-shifted. I know. Well, golly, yeah, if bare ecstatic posture is the lightweight one, I'd hesitate on going in on some of the stronger ones. But what I do love about, I know that you hold drum medicine, rattle medicine, you're adept at using those types of medicines to alter consciousness. You teach people about ecstatic posture, and often shamanism is equated with the use of or engaging in plant ceremony. But what these other modalities are really showing us is that, first of all, it's innate in our design to go into non-ordinary reality, first of all, and secondly, this fantastic link between the body and spirit, because often, again, that's another form of separation, isn't it? As we think that the body's sort of separate to the spirit and then separate to the greater consciousness of it all. But it's all actually one thing, isn't it?
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. And, because of our innate capacity to separate and label things, people are often more comfortable thinking about something that's appeared in their meditation or in their shamanic journeying as, oh, that's a spirit.
Yeah.
But that's kind of over there and it's separate.
Yeah.
And that's come to me.
Yeah.
Not a sort of clear understanding that everything is spirit.
Yeah.
Also.
Yeah.
And we are, and everything is, and the trees are spirit, and, you know, the land is spirit, and everything is one.
Yeah.
So, you know, one of the things that I think is really hard to absorb and own and adapt to ourselves is this idea that everything is one, and what we're looking at might look like separate things. What I'm looking at in the room I'm sitting in might look like separate things, but they're not. It's all one.
Yeah.
And in fact, my personality is creating what I'm looking at. And in that sense, I'm creating the world that I look at.
Yeah.
And you know, that's a whole other story.
Yeah, but it's beautiful though, like this idea of the hologram, you know, so we're generating, and it is a hologram of light. It is light because that's the only way we can perceive it really is through photon energy.
Yeah,
that's a whole other podcast, but I'm definitely getting you back for more.
And also when you talk about light, we are actually light. We're made of photons. And, you know, that's why I think being able to alter our consciousness, to go into a different space, enables us to experience ourselves more as a body of light.
Yeah.
And the body of light actually has no boundaries, you know, not like this. The body of light merges with all the other light in the world. And there's, I think there's often a fear around that because intuitively the personality knows that merging with light is the death of the personality. And yet it's not a death. I mean, I've got nothing against personalities. We need a personality in order to live in the world and make sense of things and think things through and so on. And that's part of the glory of being human, in fact. But there is this other reality that is able to be accessed, but also able to be left behind.
Yeah.
In terms of what's needed in the moment.
Yeah, absolutely. And, I mean, that is the dazzling human design, isn't it? It's spirit and matter. It's linear consciousness. It's expanded consciousness. It's light and particle and wave. You know, we're polarized beings, if you like. We exist on a pole of what could be perceived as opposites, but they're not.
Yes. And that's really how it ought to be. I've actually known a couple of people who've got stuck in this expanded space and actually not very functional. So that's okay. Maybe we need some people in the world to really hold that expanded space. I'm sure we do. And I'm sure that, you know, the Tibetan lamas who spent lifetimes living in a cave, meditating, you know, that's what they hold for the world. And you know, in enclosed orders, in enclosed religious orders, for instance, you know, that whole thing of continuously praying for the world is creating a space, it's creating an energy that is of benefit to the world. And, you know, we have to be grateful that some people want to devote their lives to that and the rest of us, you know, struggle along being a bit of one and a bit of the other.
Yeah, we do the lotus, you know, a bit in the mud and a bit open to the air.
Yeah, indeed. That's a great way to put it.
Doing the lotus. So, Louise, when I was learning with you meditation and shamanism, you did bring into our the learnings beautiful practices and perspectives from Tibetan Buddhism. And you mentioned before that you've had the privilege of meeting the Dalai Lama a couple of times. And you know, people wouldn't necessarily look at Tibetan Buddhism in relation to shamanism, yet you seem to be able to teach them seamlessly to us. Could you tell us a bit about how that worked for you and why you felt it was a necessary thread to bring into your teaching of us?
There are many schools of Tibetan Buddhism, but some of them are absolutely shamanic that if they're teaching in English, that's what they offer. There's a school called the Drukpa Kagyu, which means something about the dragon, which is a completely shamanic practice. And then in Tibet, before Buddhism came, there was an indigenous religion which was called Bon, which I think is pronounced Bun, and that was a shamanic, completely shamanic religion in the mountains with spirits guarding the various places of the mountainsides and, ceremonies having to be performed to placate those spirits. When Buddhism was brought to Tibet, creation myth of that event is that the initial teacher who had come from India to teach Buddhism worked to bring the shamanic spirit believers into Buddhism.
Yeah.
However, there is still a whole big school in northern India shamanic, the indigenous thing, which has taken a lot from Buddhism. I don't know a lot about it. I was introduced to it because I was traveling in that area and I met a man who was a part of that religion. He talked to me a lot about it, but he wasn't a teacher of it. And so that has taken on a lot of the aspects of Buddhism, and Buddhism has taken on a lot of the aspects of shamanism. So if you go into a Buddhist temple, you will often see these fierce figures, these kind of demons with mouths open and glaring eyes and claws and fangs and so on. And these are believed to have been the original shamanic guardians of the mountains who have been tamed and brought in to be the guardians of Buddhism. So that form of Buddhism is absolutely congruent and fascinatingly so. And I don't know if you've ever seen, there's an amazing DVD in which the oracles of the Tibetan diaspora, if you like, you know, the government in exile that lives in India, that used to be headed by the Dalai Lama, and now he's retired from government, but he's still the religious head. And so there are oracles, there are monks and nuns who have been recognized as being able to bring from the other world information and advice for the government. And and so the man who is the current oracle was recognized, I think he was already a monk and he was in his maybe early 20s. And the story that I heard is that the first thing that made them recognize him was he had a very severe nosebleed.
Yeah.
And one of the senior monks said, oh, okay, we've got to keep an eye on this man and start training him.
Yeah.
So that's what they did.
I thought it was a beautiful compliment to particularly the perspectives that it offers around the intelligence and the spiritual power of the heart. So, you know, you taught us those beautiful practices like Ball of Mudita Indra's Net and, you know, those, and they're all those beautiful heart-centered meditations which palpably generate a field from the heart. And for me, my experience in shamanic journeying and other sort of light trance work in shamanic practice, it feels the same to me. It feels like my heart is the engine of the practice. And when I'm perceiving information in that journey, what is the most relevant and potent information is where my heart will indicate at the time that it comes into my awareness. So it's the heart intelligence aspect of the Tibetan Buddhism practices that you taught us that, that work for me in shamanic practice. It's interesting, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah. And actually it's the heart that I rely on if I'm doing a shamanic healing, if I'm doing a soul retrieval, if I'm trying to understand what's going on, something that I can share with the person I'm working with, then, you know, that's the point of reference.
Yeah, me too. With my healing work, it's the same. Yeah, I can feel when I'm near the root, because my heart will tell me
the truth.
Yeah, the truth, you know, the truth, yeah. So, Louise, I'm going to put all of your contacts with this podcast. I'm slightly hesitant to do so because I just want to keep you to myself. But, but you know, if someone was listening to this and it was, and what we've talked about today has really resonated with them and they thought, this is something I really want to explore. Obviously, we can't travel at the moment with COVID. What are a couple of things that you could suggest to someone to start opening up their the first steps into a shamanic path? What would you tell someone would be some good tips?
Go outside.
Yeah.
get into the bush, get into the nearest bit of landscape that you can, lean against a tree. You can do a beautiful little ceremony to kind of adopt a tree in your garden or in your area. You know, you can just take a little bowl of water and put it at the base of the tree, maybe with a flower, maybe burn a stick of incense with, you know, and just lean against the tree. You know, I had a tree where I've just moved house, but I had a tree where I used to live that was such a support to me. And also my daughter independently found the same tree and it was an incredible support for her at times in her life. And it wasn't until sometime later we realized that we both found the same tree.
Yeah.
That tree, and this is part of the sort of ongoing cycle of life, really. We had a very severe droughts here a few years ago. Not that many, four or five years ago, very, very severe droughts in Sydney. And that tree died and I hadn't been back to it for quite some time and it was such a shock to me to walk around the bush path and there's the tree completely fallen over and all the roots just up towards the sky. So, you know, I've sat with that tree in its life and in its death.
Yeah. And it is a relationship, isn't it? It's a relationship. Yeah, it's beautiful. And like all relationships, you know, which is an element of shamanism, there's got to be a bit of gifting and some generosity and some honouring from both sides, you know. So we see in all forms of shamanism this idea of making offerings and the expression of gratitude as well to the earth and to the nature spirits and creation and so on. And that's really what it's about, isn't it? It's about fostering relationship.
Yes, and I mean, we haven't touched on this, but for people who have a special animal, I mean, in shamanism we'd call it a power animal that helps them in their journeys. We really believe that you don't only call on the animal when you want something.
Yeah.
You know, you go to the animal just to connect, just to have fun. You know, do a little journey in which you and the animal go on a picnic.
You know,
it's light and enjoyable, but it's gifting back to that animal spirit that has helped you.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, and I remember that, and I do that from when you taught us, and now my students do that too. They go in and just hang out and take little treats. Yeah. Louise Gilmore, I love you.
And, I love you too, Danny, my star student.
Oh, that's what I like to hear. And thank you so much for your time. And it's just always a pleasure talking to you. And I'd love to get you back. And I'm sure this is going to be popular. And there's so much more that we can talk about. But thank you for today. Just fantastic.
My pleasure. And Danny, thank you for the work that you're doing, because you are really expanding the whole thing. You know, talk about the student, you know, outstripping the teacher. I have great admiration for you also.
Thank you, Louise. Thank you so much. All right. Bye.
Bye.